Kelly Pollack. Just one moment. Kelly has been a national facilitator of Schools Attuned since 1997 and has developed and implemented curriculum for the Schools Attuned course and various other workshops on neurodevelopment. She received her master's in special education from Bank Street College of Education and taught for 4 years at the Churchill School in New York City. In Livingston, New Jersey, Kelly served as a middle school inclusion teacher prior to moving into mainstream classrooms where she taught from 3rd through 6th grades. She has been an adjunct professor at Bank Street and served as a field facilitator for Schools Attuned, helping educators to implement neurodevelopmental thinking and analysis in their classrooms and schools. Kelly is currently tutoring students with learning disabilities and developing curriculum for Hidden Sparks. I'm also delighted to introduce our technical facilitator, Betsy Kane, who's going to be working with Kelly tonight. Welcome, Kelly and Betsy. And Kelly, now on to you.
Thank you so much, Judith, and good evening, everybody. I often have time management problems, so I'm just going to jump right into the first slide, which outlines our session goals. There are two primary goals for this session, as you see on slide number one. The first one is to experience firsthand learning about learning activities that have been successful with students. These are either activities that I've seen done with students or done myself with students. So you'll get to see actual activities and lessons that have been done with students and are learning about learning activities. And the second one is to develop questioning techniques that will guide students in understanding and analyzing their own learning. And my other hope is that you leave not only with the activities that I'm showing you tonight, you can leave with some of those and try these activities out in your own classroom. But hopefully some of these activities will be the beginnings or the sparks of ideas that you can then go on to develop for your own students. So hopefully these activities will spark your own creativity. Okay, so the next slide. I always like to start with thinking about ourselves as learners. I think that's such an important thing for us to do, is just to kind of touch base with ourselves as learners and think about what it is to be a learner. And we all wonder things and have wondered things about our own learning, just as children do. So my first question to you to get the ball rolling is, what questions have you had in the past or do you still have about your own learning? And this would be a time where if you have a question that you've had, I'm not necessarily going to answer it, but we just want to hear them to get ourselves going. You can either write them in the chat room or you can say them to us. So it's just a brainstorm. What kind of questions do you have or have you had about your own learning? Don't make me call on you. I'll just choose numbers. I'll say call in user number 3.
I'm always very curious about organization, like mm-hmm. organization in my brain and
yeah.
and how to organize my thoughts or even content.
Okay. Thank you. Well, one of the things I'll share about myself, and I, talking about learning have shared with children as well, is that my active working memory is very strong in almost every area, except when it taps into doing mental math, arithmetic in my head. Again, very good with active working memory and juggling multiple things in my mind at once. And I'm also good at math in general, and have done calculus and all that as long as I can write it out. But the manipulation of numbers in my head is something that always perplexed me. And it wasn't until graduate school, that I really learned what it was that was going on, that it actually was an active working memory issue. And that's one of the reasons that we're doing this session tonight is, you know, I always wonder, wouldn't it be helpful for children to understand their own learning their own styles, their own approaches to problems, their own strategies, their own methods, way before adulthood, which is when many of us really started to understand and answer some of those questions about our own learning, especially as teachers. We have the benefit of really going back and saying, wow, that's why I do that, or that's why I think this way. And many times children are wondering the same things that we're wondering about. So that's one of the things we want to keep in mind tonight. How can we help children to understand their own learning? Okay, the next slide. Let's just get this out in the open. One of the concerns that teachers have posed over the years, and it's a legitimate one, is that, you know, boy, it would be nice to teach learning and to teach children how they learn, but we're just so inundated with so many other demands. We just don't have the time. So one of the things I wanted to bring up just at the get-go here is the way I've worked in learning about learning, and many other teachers have done as well, is really kind of a two-prong approach. The first one is developing short activities. And when I say short, I mean anywhere from 10 minutes to maybe 30 minutes. That are focused on one or more of the learning pathways. So a short activity or a few activities really just focused on memory or attention to bring up the salient pieces that you would like your children to learn about, right? And then the other one is learning about learning while the children are already learning. So taking pieces of content, lessons that you're already teaching, and working in questioning that will help them to understand how it is that they're learning, the processes that they're using, the strategies that they're using. So those are two ways that we find the time to teach this very valuable idea of how children learn. Okay? And you'll get examples of both activities that are independent of content and then activities that are kind of embedded in the content that you're already teaching. I'll try to balance tonight the two. Okay, you'll see examples of both. Okay, the next slide. This is going to be kind of one of the foundations that we use tonight, and these are really thinking about the types, the kind of categories of questions that you might use, might think about when you're asking children questions about their learning. And I should just get out this out here. This is my way of thinking about the types of questions. There are surely other types of questions and other ways of categorizing these questions, but this is just kind of how my mind works and how I categorize the questions that I use. One of them is just emotions. So you might ask children questions like, how did this activity or how did this lesson make you feel? You can get a ton of information about that because kids don't just say, I didn't like it. They really, for the most part, many children really want to tell you about what happened and why they were feeling either good or not so good about a particular activity. And why do you think you felt like this? Maybe a little bit deeper for some children. Some of the questions I ask are about choices. For example, which method or strategy works better for you and why? And the first activity will take a look at that question in particular. Or if you're observing a student solving a problem, you might say something like, I was noticing that you changed how you were solving that problem. Why did you do that? Why did you go from this way of solving it to that? Why did you change? Just to get that student thinking and articulating about why they made that change, that decision. Some of the questions we ask are more about the process. So how did you do that would be a question about process. And what worked well for you and what didn't, right? If there were five different steps, would there be one of them that you would do again? Or, you know, would you do it exactly the same if you were to do that problem again? And I see there's a question here. At what age should we start teaching about how to learn? That's a great question. Let me just hold on just for 1 second about that. Let's just get to that last category, and then I'll pose that to the group. And then there's the extension kind of questions that might not even have to do specifically with the activity, but I always like to throw in there, even with younger students, something like, do you have to be good at this anywhere else at school? And this meaning whatever the targeted skill or learning pathway is. Or can you use this strategy at home or in a sport or when you're painting a picture? Does this strategy, will this work for you in other places? I love this question. What do you think? At what age should we start teaching about how to learn? What do you think? When would this work? Of course, it's going to look different depending on the age, right? Any ideas about that? Any feelings? I know we do have some teachers, at least a couple, that teach very young children, right? Like fours and fives.
I would say from the first year, it means Aleph class.
Could you say that again?
I'm saying the first grade.
Okay. Okay.
And I know that you meant that we have different ways of learning too.
Right.
And is it all about?
I'm sorry, I missed that also. Is it all about?
I'm saying that before you ask, and I'm saying that there are many ways for learning.
Yes. Yes, absolutely. There are.
It's connected to the brain, yeah.
Yes, absolutely. So many. And that's always nice, it's a nice way to start with children, right? Activities and discussions that really put out that big idea of we all learn differently, right? We all have different methods. We all use different strategies. We all have different feelings about different activities and different subjects in school, and that's all very normal. And those are wonderful ways to those are wonderful ideas to kind of get out there right at the beginning of the school year, really, because you know it's very difficult to have these sort of discussions later on if you don't have that foundation already. I always try to set up a classroom where these are just things that we talked about. We talked about things that work for us and things that weren't working for us. And if I needed help with my organization, I knew, you know, which other student to go to help me with that, because I knew what other people's strengths were. I also like that idea of, you had mentioned first grade at starting. I would put it out there that you could probably start even earlier. I have a kindergartner myself, and I know we have lots of conversations, just as we're doing her homework about memory and about her attention. And about her impulsivity and about how different her attention is at home versus at school. So there are lots of ways that you can talk to younger students. And we'll get to that in just a little while. I have a couple of things that have to do with first graders. So we can look at the differences between talking to a first grader and talking to, say, a middle schooler. Okay? Okay, let's move to the next slide. Okay. Talking about first graders, we're going to jump right in here with a pretend lesson, but it's one that you would see in a lot of first grade classrooms. You've set up the following centers around the room in which your first graders are going to be practicing spelling their sight words. And for those of you who teach older students, sight words are high-frequency words, and I gave you a few examples, am, the, is, like, or a few. And the problem with a lot of sight words is that many don't get spelled phonetically. So they're just words that you have to remember and recognize. Okay, they're tougher words for some children. Okay, let me briefly tell you the centers that this teacher set up. She set up a center where children got a cookie sheet, and she sprayed shaving cream on it, and they flattened out the shaving cream and smoothed it out, and they practiced writing their words in the shaving cream. Very messy, but fun. Another center was called Rainbow Writing, where they got a piece of paper with each word, and they had lots of different colors of crayons, and they traced the word in different colors over and over and over again until each word looked like a rainbow. Another center was a sky writing station, which many of you early childhood teachers are familiar with, where children hold their arm out straight and they write in the air, nice and big, the letters, the different words. There's a center that called Listen and Visualize. That's where a teacher would be, where a teacher helped students to visualize the letters and the words as she was saying them. So she would say, was. Try to picture W-A-S, was. She would help the kids even maybe do that in different colors to see if they were able to picture the words in their minds. There was a setup where singing the sight words, where children could listen on tape to a little musical jingles where the words are spelled and then used in a funny sentence, and all of this was set to music. And then children were, there was a center where they were writing on each other's backs, and if you could picture one child writing on the other's back the word is, I-S, with their finger, and then the child whose back was being written on had to guess what word the child was written was writing on their back. Okay, so lots of different ways, right, to input, right, to get this into memory. And I just put this out to you, the question on the bottom. What are some topics that we might be able to introduce in this kind of activity? And by the way, this is something many first grade teachers do, on a weekly basis. This might be even a couple times a week where children get to visit these sight word centers. What do you think? Let's do a brainstorm. What are some learning about learning topics that you could introduce here if you were this teacher?
Well, I can tell you, my name is Edna.
Yep.
That I'm using some of those techniques on spelling.
Yes.
Even reviewing some subjects on questions and their answers on a shaving cream or on sand or
yes.
Whatever it is. I mean, they can do it. Almost every subject.
Yes.
If it's a small group, it's much easier to do that.
It sure is. It sure is. Okay, and we've got a lot of chat room ideas coming on. We have introducing how we learn through different modalities. Right, absolutely. That learning can be fun. Sure. Although not all of these activities might be fun for all children, so that might be something that you pose to them. Which ones were fun for you? There might be children to say, I hate when people touch my back, right? Some children might be very sensitive to that, and that might not help them at all. That might make them very uncomfortable. And then Barbara is saying that the teachers using all of the modalities, visual, auditory, kinesthetic, etc., you could observe and discuss which activity worked best. What a great idea to say to children, boy, which activity is working best for you? Which activity is helping you most to remember how to spell these words? Great. When you think about the activity, Sarah asks, which stands out to you that you would use again yourself? Wonderful. What wonderful questions. Actually, I'm going to go to the next slide because we're already there. One of the things, and really what you're all getting at is the idea of long-term memory. We could have tapped into some other learning pathways here, but really it's a long-term memory activity, right? You want the children to store those words in their long-term memory, right? One of the things I wanted to know from you is how you would introduce the idea to begin with. And you've got some ideas already. And any other ideas about how you would even introduce this idea to your first grade students?
The idea of long-term memory or the
yeah.
idea of the modalities?
Yeah, and just the whole, either one. Yeah, either one. And the idea of using different modalities to store things into long-term memory. What would be a relatively simple idea for just introducing that? It could be even with a question.
There's a comment in the chat room.
Oh. Ask them to give examples of things they remember. That's great. What are some things that we remember really easily, and what are some things that it is difficult for us to remember? Great. Great simple opening that's very appropriate for first graders. You know, I'm also wondering just something like, why do we do this each week, right? Every week we're doing these centers, right? Sometimes they're the same. Sometimes we change them a little bit. But, gosh, why do we do this, right? That might be a nice opening for students just to start thinking. I might also say something about, like, while you're working at the centers today, I want you to really start thinking about which centers are the most helpful to you, as one of the participants have already said, so that they can start thinking. It also just sets that tone of, I want you to tell me about what's working for you so that, I want centers that are really helping you So you've got to tell me which ones are the ones that are really helping you. And if everybody says to me, gosh, that, I don't know, that visualizing station, nobody, it's really not working for anyone, well, I'm going to replace that with a different one then, right? So really being responsive to what they're telling you as well. Now, let's think a little bit more about the questions that you might ask them. We've talked a bit about some of the before the centers questions. How about the after the centers questions? What are some things that you might ask them after they go through the centers related to long-term memory and their strategies?
There's something left of their homework.
Can you say that one more time? I heard homework.
I'm wondering if anyone might have ideas about if they remember the words better now than they did before.
That's great.
They feel like their memory is better.
Absolutely. Yep. Yep. And particularly which centers worked for them, right? Which centers do they think were most helpful? You might even say something with first graders. If you gave them the opportunity to choose the centers and when they went to each one, perhaps you don't make them go to each one, right? Maybe they have to choose two or three. Which center did you choose first? Why did you choose that center first? What was it that drew you to that center, right? You could ask them if they changed anything about the center that they were at to make it work better for them. Maybe they made little changes, right, that made it more meaningful to them. I also love to ask children questions like, can you think of other centers that we could set up for our sight words? Right, because another student might say, you know, I like to feel things. Could we use those magnetic letters? And you might say, gosh, absolutely, let's give it a try. And let's set it up for next time and we'll see how that works, right? Again, learning about learning, but also being responsive to students' ideas about learning. The one other thing that I might do with this type of activity, even with young children, would be after I introduce the idea before the centers, I might say, you know, while you're working, think about what center's helping you. I might add to that a little rating scale to say, you know, center number one. It could be something as easy as thumbs up, thumbs down, and they circle whether it was, you know, whether it worked for them, and maybe a little note section if they wanted to remember anything that they wanted to share. With older students, it could be a question that they journal about in their writing journal. Right, so you could have a more formal kind of way of them recording. It also makes them accountable for thinking about their learning process as they're going through. They've got to circle that thumbs up or thumbs down and think about it before they rush off to another station. Okay, that was a great, great start. I want to vary the discussion, so let's move to the next slide. And obviously, we've moved on from first grade here. We've graduated. This is around a fourth or fifth grade topic that we're talking about. Some of you might see this in if you work with some of the coaches. I want you to think here about the way you probably learned multiplication, probably that top method there, which nowadays is called the traditional method, right? Because oftentimes, you know, in many schools, children are taught multiple methods for solving problems and algorithms. Let's pretend that you're a fourth or fifth grade teacher, and that you've introduced both methods to your students, because lots of times nowadays, that's what's happening. Let me give you just a 20 seconds or so just to take a look at both of the methods, and you can ask questions to clarify. Is there anybody that's perplexed by either method? That might really give us a sense of, you're learning, right? What are some of the demands of each method? How about that first method, that what we would call the traditional method? What do you need to be good at in order to kind of successfully complete a problem in this way?
I think organization.
Yes, absolutely. You've got to be very organized. Yeah, very sequential.
Yes.
Right? You've got to be able to line up the numbers, as Julie said. Barbara said sequencing, absolutely. If you don't do those steps in the right sequence, that's going to be real trouble. Okay, so Julie's saying her fourth graders struggle with that, the sequence, right? There's also a spatial component of that problem, and that is the lining up the numbers, right? Because the lining up the numbers really is a place value issue. If you mess up the lining up of the numbers spatially, you're going to be adding two numbers on the bottom that don't really go together, right? Okay, yeah, so down to the bottom one, Julie is saying that the bottom uses more mental math in a way. Interesting. I'm not sure it uses more mental math. Let's think about that. Let's see. So you've still got to, you know, in the top method, you've still got to do some working out in your head, right? But it's the basic math facts, right? And the bottom one is a little bit more complicated, right? Because you've got your 40 and your 30. So there's a little bit more, it's a little bit more heavy on the mental math. And Barbara, yes, the second one is absolutely spatial. Probably, you know, in some ways, arguably more spatial, at least set up more spatially, right? For children who are more spatial, that might work better for them, right? You might think about, as I pose this question up here, and I would do this with my students, which method works better for your type of mind? And I would ask, I would start off with that. Which one? We've introduced both methods. Some of you grumbled about one method. Some of you grumbled about the other method. Some of you are, you know, perfectly happy doing either one. Let's talk about that, right? Yes, there's also another method, the lattice multiplication, which is a little bit more complicated, and it really involves both sequences and spatial. Yep. Thanks, Julie. Are there other questions that you might pose to fourth and fifth graders after learning both of these types of, you know, ways to solve this problem? What would you want to touch on here with them?
Which one helps them better?
Okay. Which one helps you more? Yep. And I would go to why. What is it about the other one that you don't like? What is it about this one that you do like? Some people might say, I can never remember that carrying thing, the one on top. I don't really understand that, right? The bottom method takes out the, you know, 8 times 2, carry the one, or however you you teach that to your students, right? There's no regrouping there. Some children just love the fact that they don't have to deal with that. Okay. Some people might not like the heavier mental math that's required, as we heard before from Julie. So they might stick with that first one. The sequence, does it matter in the second one which order you multiply those numbers? Nope, it doesn't. You can multiply them in any order, and you can add them in any order. So the sequencing is taken out there. Okay. The other thing that I like to do, particularly with older students, but it would work with younger students as well. I have more experience with older students. But I would do like a turn and talk at this point. I would say turn and talk with your neighbor, and talk about which method works better for you, and tell your partner why you chose that method, why you're going to be solving these problems using that method. And then you could have a group discussion. Did any of the partners have the same choice as their partner? And was anybody really perplexed about why their partner chose the other type? Boy, they just don't see it, because that way is so difficult for them, right? So again, it's saying it's okay. These are both valid methods. And as Julie is saying, one may work for them and not another person. So what a nice way to say, boy, some people agree. Some people boy, they just don't understand where the other person's coming from. They can't imagine doing it that other way. Okay? And again, it's kind of laying a foundation of we all work differently and our minds all work differently as well. Okay? Okay. Let's move on. And please, by all means, either in the chat room or verbally, just stop me if I'm going too fast or if you have any other questions. I'm going to switch gears a little bit again in thinking about not just a particular task, but a class-wide learning issue. This is the scenario. You're a sixth-grade teacher, and 2 weeks ago, you gave your sixth graders a long-term project to culminate the end of your unit on the Civil War, so it could be anything. Despite having given them choices for the type of project, descriptions of each part, and a list of due dates for each part, many students are still not handing things in according to those due dates that you set out. So I really want to talk about a little process here that we could use. And again, this process could be used with one student, or it really could be used with a whole class, as in this scenario. The first thing I would suggest you doing is just to articulate the problem, because sometimes we just let emotions take hold, right? And we're just frustrated. You've got to hand things in on time, right? But just to sit back, take a step back, and articulate the problem. And really, this is what I've done here for this teacher. So the problem is you've done all these things, and the kids are still not handing things in on time. Number two, think about the demands. Now, we don't know the particular project, but we do know that the teacher's given different choices, so the kids have some say in what type of project. Think about that. What are the demands of this type of assignment for a sixth grader? What needs to be in place for students to be successful with this type of project? This is just a little brainstorm. What do they have to be able to do or know? Okay, they've got to know research. Yep, they've got to be doing some research.
Organize facts. Organize
they've got to be able to organize their information. They've got to be able to plan. So there's a definite, like a time management organizational piece that's very heavy here. You know, also going back to the basics, they've got to be able to read and write independently. Certainly not true for all sixth graders, right? Some children are still struggling with those basic skills. They've got to narrow down an aspect of the content to focus on, right? There's lots of choices involved here. Choices for the type of project, likely choices within the type of project and how they're going to display or kind of publish their ideas. Yeah, absolutely. To know what they're capable of and not overestimate what they want to do. Yeah, to have reasonable expectations in terms of what they're able to do and the time they have to do it in and all the other activities that they have and, right, how much time. Maybe too many choices. Yep, maybe for some children, too many choices, so narrow them down. Or at least give them advice. Boy, I see you doing, this one or this one. I'm not sure these other three are really your style. What do you think about that, right? Some children just need that quick conversation for you to say, let's get rid of these. Let's focus on these. Choose between these two. Mm-hmm. All wonderful ideas. I'm also thinking, you could. Now we're getting to the strategies here. Edna's saying provide a rubric chart. Absolutely very valuable, particularly at this level. I'm also thinking some students who go to do a project and really what's getting in the way is the fact that they were not really comfortable with the concepts and the information while you were studying them, right? So they might be shaky on some of those concepts for a variety of reasons, maybe language-based, maybe attention and memory-based, so that now you're asking them to to culminate all of their learning in this project, and that's their breakdown, right? So it could be a breakdown in understanding, okay, and not necessarily in the output itself. And Julie's saying they have to break it down further for some students. Absolutely. So you may think that you've really broken it down and organized it well, and some students may need it broken down even further, okay? So all wonderful ideas. All right, now I need your help. middle school teachers particularly, but anybody can chime in here. Let's hear your words. How do you open up this discussion with middle school students? How do you bring up this topic? And what questions do you have for them? What do you want to know? You've articulated the problem. You've thought about all the different breakdown points that could be happening. How do you open up this discussion with them?
I'm sorry, when you say articulate the problem in mm-hmm. number one, that's
yep.
to yourself or?
Yeah, that's to yourself. Yep. Yeah. Yep, that's just to yourself. Really, one and two are really just to yourself, okay? And then number three and four would be with the students. Yep. We've got an idea here. You might say, it seems like there's a problem. Let's discuss how we can make progress in this area, right? Would you ask them what the problem is? Yeah, what's your problem, right? Where are the difficulties for each of them? Yeah, and I wonder if they know. You might even, for fifth or sixth graders, have to say, well, here are my ideas, right, just as we just brainstorm. Boy, I'm noticing there are so many different things I'm asking you to do, right? You might even ask them to brainstorm that list if you think they'd be able to, or you could just give it to them. And you can say, if you're having difficulty getting these assignments in on time, where do you think the problem is? You might even have to give them that little list, that kind of task analysis that we just went through, right? So they can say, God, I think for me, it's organizing my ideas. Or for me, there's just too many choices. I can't get past that. So that you can get an idea of, you know, are many of them struggling with the same piece? Well, that makes it easier for you, right? Is everybody kind of struggling with their own piece, which is making it difficult for them to get things in on time? And I think in terms of strategies, once you've identified some of the problems, you could really go two ways with this structurally. If there is a common theme to the problems, the idea that I would pose is, what can we do to make this easier? How can we get this done? Because I want you all to succeed. You might even say, I have some ideas. Do you think these would work for you? Right? Or the kids might have some ideas. It's just not enough time. We're all stressed out because you only gave us 3 weeks and we have, a science test and a social studies test coming up and we can't get to this right now, are they learning about their learning? Could you say a little bit more, Barbara? I'll try to answer that. The process that we're – oh, okay, that's fine. The process that they are going through in this discussion to say, gosh, here's this assignment I have. It's not getting done. And posing these questions to them is really at a sixth grade level, taking them through where breakdown points for them would be. And that would absolutely be helping them to learn about where they're learning, what's not working, and then what strategies they need to implement. And in terms of those strategies, what I might do is if there's a common problem, you could discuss as a group, what do we need to do, what do I need to do, and what do you need to do. If there are different problems that come up, I've done this even at a fourth grade level, I have formed groups to brainstorm solutions. So there might be a group who is struggling with one particular breakdown and then another group that's struggling with another. And then kids who are already succeeding can help to problem solve within those groups. But really, I just wanted to put out the structure to you. I found this very helpful in my thinking about all sorts of problems that come up related to learning with students. Group problems, problems with individual students. We've used this at a school-wide level to say the problem in school, in this school, is what are the demands, right? Have a discussion. Try out a change. And then you also see that arrow. Sometimes the changes don't work. Right? Sometimes you might think, okay, we got it. We've got some good strategies in place. Oh, gosh, they're not working. Huh. All right, let's go back to those demands. are we working on strategies for the right demand, right? Did we hit the nail on the head the first time, or maybe we're overlooking something, we need to go back. Maybe there's something else that's getting in the way, right? I think we're going to move on. And again, shift our thinking a little bit. I know in this hour we're shifting our thinking a lot, but I want to leave you with lots of ideas to spark your thinking. This is my lovely middle daughter, Maddie. She is almost six, and she was just the model for this activity. This is an example of an activity that is outside, independent of a lesson. This is an activity where a first grade teacher developed that I was working with, and she noticed around, you know, couldn't help but notice really in September that she had a group of first graders that were extremely distracted, more so than usual, by everything she described, sounds, people, visuals in the room, so she had to be careful about what she, you know, what she hung up in the room, objects on desk, other people talking, and she identified the problem and said, my gosh, what am I going to do to help them to build awareness of this problem that they were having. So I'm just going to walk you through the main parts of her approach to this, and you can tell me what you think at the end. She started off by saying something to the effect of, you know, I'm noticing that some of you are really distracted by things around you. Raise your hand if you feel distracted sometimes. Of course, almost every child raised their hand, which is wonderful in and of itself, right? Everybody looks around, gosh, I thought I was the only one that was distracted. No, everybody's distracted sometimes, right? And she said, well, you know what? Let's think about this. Let's make a list of some of the things that distract us. And as they gave answers about what distracted them, she recorded them on chart paper. What do you think they said? Any ideas? What do you think first graders might be distracted by? Other students, absolutely. Yep, that was a big one.
Things outside the window?
Things outside the window, yep. As I remember, they had a pet in the classroom. They had a pet iguana. I mean, it barely moved, but it was so distractible to some students. I mean, these answers ranged everything from people walking in, people walking by, the PA system going off with announcements. some of the kids were even starting to talk about thoughts that they had in their head, thinking about what they were doing after school, thinking about their birthday coming up, thinking about their grandpa coming to visit, all sorts of thoughts that they had, in addition to the auditory and the visual distractions that we tend to think about, just thought distractions they talked about as well. After they got that list going, oh, interesting bulletin boards, absolutely, she said something to the effect of, who thinks these distractions get in the way of their learning? And a couple of students were brave enough to raise their hands, and she said, can you tell us a little bit about that so that we can learn a little bit? Because, you know, this happens to everybody. So if you could tell us about this, that might help all of us to understand what's going on in our own minds. So a few students reported that they thought it was getting in their learning, and they shared what that was like for them. And she then went on to, she started off with introducing this idea of the light. And she said what she was noticing with them was that their heads were going back and forth and up and down and all around, when really in doing that they were missing things that they really needed to be paying attention to. So she got this idea of the headlight, and she let the kids try it out. She had a neat room where you could dim the lights so they weren't, you know, totally done. And this was just for a day. Everybody got a chance. It might have been a couple of days, actually. Everybody got a chance to try on that headlight for at least, you know, 15 minutes or so. Yes, it was time spent. But her thinking was, my gosh, if I don't get them a little bit more aware of what's going on, I'm wasting so much time during all my days trying to get their attention back. If I can put the time in now to help them to learn about this part of their learning, I think it will be a little time well spent for me this year. So everybody got a chance at it, and they got to try out the light. And then afterward, and it was silly. The kids laughed a lot. There were some lights when kids were wearing them. They were going, as you would imagine, with this class. And then there were some lights that were exactly in the right place all the time. The kids were noticing this. And then afterward, this teacher had a discussion, a few of them, about what it was like to wear the light. She went back to the list, and she said, which of those things, after wearing the light, do you think distracted you the most? Where was your headlight going the most? Was it the noises that were distracting? Was it the birds outside that were distracting? And in doing this, she helped the children to categorize the list together. And the kids decided on the categories. And as I remember, they, in their own first grade words, it was like things you see, things you hear, things you think about. Those were some of them, as I recall. And then for the rest of the year, she did such an interesting thing. Because she kind of set this out for them, she then referred to it by saying, where is your light shining? And that was their cue, as if they were still wearing them. Anytime she said, where is your light shining, they thought about it, and they thought, oh, gosh, where should I be paying attention? And I love this idea. It's creative. She was thinking out of the box. She absolutely grabbed their attention. And I just thought it was a great way of making the idea of learning about learning accessible to young children. And I just want to, I know I talked a lot, but I just wanted to explain that to you. And I'm interested in your thoughts about this lesson. What you think about that? Does it spark any ideas for you? Do you think you could use something like this with your children? What are your thoughts?
It provides such a concrete.
Yeah.
Just it concretizes the whole notion of of attention.
Yeah. Yep. Okay, so what did she do when they had the lights on? She was teaching. And again, it was silly, but she was trying to go through her daily lessons. And because that's what she wanted them to see. As I'm up here, if I'm here at the, at the calendar and we're doing something with our calendar math, where are you looking, right? Where is your attention? Is it down at your fingernails or, at the person who's walking in? So she was teaching. Okay, yeah, making them more accountable. It builds awareness like no other activity that I've seen in a while, which is why I liked it so much. It made it fun. It made the whole idea of talking about attention fun. And the extra added bonus of it was so powerful that she used it for the rest of the year. She would just simply say, she was a very, very quiet teacher, but she had a wonderful presence, and she would very gently say, where are your lights shining? And it brought them back. It was so meaningful to them, the experience, that they always knew exactly what she meant. Okay, hopefully that will spark some ideas. It might not be good for middle school students, but you might think of another idea that would be more appropriate for them with this attention concept. Okay, if we can go to the next slide. I'm going to go through this one a little bit quicker in the interest of time, and I think we've done so much work in terms of thinking about questions already. I do want to just explain it. This would be an activity, just a checklist activity, where you could start off with a sentence starter like I am good at. And this one I helped the teacher to organize around the concept of spatial ordering. She wanted them to understand what spatial ordering was and to have a better sense of whether that was a strength or a weakness, or whether they had some strengths and some weaker areas within spatial ordering. As you can see, it's just a simple checklist. So she gave out the checklist to each student, and she this was, I believe, as I remember, a first grade classroom as well. And she went through it, read it aloud to them, and they checked off the things that they felt as if they had a strength in, that they were good at. And then she had a discussion about it. And I'm going to jump ahead a little bit with this one. because I just want you to think, are there other checklists like this that you feel as if you could develop? I think it's a relatively easy way to start this process of talking about learning about learning. You don't have to do something like the Miner's Headlight if either you can't think of something like that, or you don't have the time. A simple checklist might be more up your alley. Can you think of any checklists, topics for checklists that you might be able to implement relatively soon? Okay, so Julie's saying a multiple intelligence checklist. So, yeah, there's lots of those online that are even downloadable where you can use them so that kids get a sense of whether they're more kinesthetic or auditory or visual, et cetera. Yep. You know, going back to the distractions, you could set up a checklist about things that you're distracted by. We've got a comment. I'd ask all of the students for things, okay, that could distract them, right? Put them together into a checklist and then start off the discussion with that, yeah. You could, going back to memory, to say, maybe make a list of the 10 common things in third grade that they're responsible for remembering. Which ones are easy for you to remember? Which ones are more difficult for you to remember? Also, a nice question would be, something to the effect of, are any of these like each other? For example, let's see, memory games and remembering shapes. You know, they're both spatial, but they both have to do with, like, a spatial memory. So they might be able to connect some of them, right? Let's see. From a coaching perspective, great to have something like this for each of the constructs. Yep, I did. This one actually is, Barbara, in the one that I put in with the most recent ordering materials for the coaches. So look for that one, but I will take note of that and make some of those. It would even help when teachers are learning about constructs. Absolutely. Okay. Great. Will do. So think about checklists. It might take the pressure off of you if you're interested in starting learning about learning discussions and don't know where to start. Checklists are a nice concrete way to do it. It might help you to kind of get in the groove. Okay, I can't leave our discussion without showing you Dennis the Menace, who comes next. I've had this, like, for a really long time, and I just love this. Again, we're on the topic of attention. Poor Dennis is in the corner here, and he's got a think bubble. And he's thinking, by the time I think about what I'm going to do, I already did it. And I would just put out there, if you look in the comics section, there are so many comics that have to do with learning. And again, a fun, engaging way to get kids thinking about their different ways of learning. Attention, there's lots to do with language and memory as well, and organization and time and things like that. So be on the lookout if you're just sitting on the train or a bus and you have nothing else to do. Look at the comics and see if there's a learning about learning opportunity in the comic strips. In the interest of time, I'm going to give you a few ideas here. What learning pathways might be leveraged here? I've used this for attention, specifically impulsivity, right? That idea of moving too fast, doing things without thinking them through. Could also be kind of merged with social cognition, depending on what Dennis did, right? Or maybe language. What questions? Boy, I would think, gosh, can you explain this, right? Just make sure that they understand it. What happened to Dennis? Why is he in the corner, right? And then, of course, has this ever happened to you? Is it a situation that you're willing to describe and tell us about, or do you want to keep it private, right? But this kind of thing has happened to everybody, where we just think but don't think, right, and just do without thinking. One of the other things that I was thinking about for Dennis, but I haven't asked kids this, is do you think the punishment will help Dennis? Why or why not? Do you think sitting in the corner is going to make it easier next time he's in that situation? Okay, so those are all, that would be an example of like an extension question for them, right, a bit of a higher level question. They might have lots of things to say about punishments and whether punishments and different punishments work, particularly when it has to do with learning kind of issues, right? This might be an impulsive kid. Boy, is sitting in the corner going to help him, you know, develop strategies to think before he does, right? Can you extend the conversation into a short activity? Can you take this? We don't want to take this. Well, you could. You could just have a discussion about it. But if you wanted to, could you extend this into a short activity? Does anybody have an idea about where could you go next with this? With this, what could you do after this to get them either thinking more or applying this or thinking a little bit deeper about this idea of impulsivity? I know I'm asking you to be creative very quickly. Yeah, great. So think about what other alternatives he could have used. Great. A role play. I think that's a great idea. Yep. You could have different, like one kid be Dennis and one kid be Dennis's mother or Dennis's teacher or, right? And think about what that conversation might be like. That's a great idea. To write Dennis a letter, right? It could be a journaling activity where they write Dennis a letter and give him some strategies for his impulsivity. You could also discuss or write ideas, an alternate comic. Yeah, I like that. You could also have them think about what happened right before this picture. What was the scenario that got Dennis here, right? And that actually brings me to my next slide, because anytime I'm thinking about impulsivity, I want kids and parents, when they're involved, to think about the different implications impulsivity has. So if we could go to the next slide, I just want to show you this, and you can use this if you'd like. This is just, again, this is how I might extend that conversation about the comic strip. To give them some scenarios there on the left, for example, you answer a question on a quiz too quickly, right, without thinking. Again, getting to consequences. What might the result be? What might happen? You say something to a friend without thinking it through when you're frustrated. What might happen? And then you kick a ball in a soccer game too quickly without looking at your other options or without thinking it through. What might happen? I really like kids to understand about impulsivity that you know, it kind of can happen in many different settings, and also just to think about what are the implications of doing things without thinking it through. Okay. I do see that we're at 9 o'clock. And for me, this is pretty good because I did just have a couple other slides that I wanted to show you. And I understand that some people need to check out for various reasons, but if you could just give me 5 more minutes, I think that's as closest to on time as I've been in a webinar. So, that's pretty good for me. If we could go and finish off with the last few slides. We're at a fourth grade level here, and this is what I'm calling just a longer-term endeavor. If you try out a bunch of learning about learning activities and you feel so inclined, you could build a little mini unit on a particular learning pathway or learning idea. I want to just give you one example of what that might look like, and this is one that I had developed when I was working in New Jersey. I was given the job of, I was within a nonfiction unit, and I was responsible for teaching a variety of nonfiction reading strategies and methods for recording nonfiction information, but I was given a lot of leeway in terms of what materials I used. So I chose 2 of Dr. Melavine's books because I really wanted to get a little bit deeper into learning about learning. So I chose Dr. Levine's All Kinds of Minds and Keeping Ahead in School. I would highly suggest reading them and using them with students. So those were kind of the core of the nonfiction work that we had done for this mini unit. I started off with a discussion, and some of the questions that I posed were, what does it mean to pay attention? Lots of different ideas about what it looks like and what it means to pay attention. Fourth graders were really got into, do you have to look at somebody to pay attention, or could you look down to pay attention? And they really were very nitpicky and had very specific things that they thought needed to be true in order for you to pay attention. So that was interesting. How do you know when you are paying attention and you aren't paying attention? What makes it hard to pay attention? And again, what happens when you're not paying attention? What are some of the consequences of not paying attention in fourth grade? And then what do you do about it? What happens when you're kind of daydreamed, for example, and then you come back? What are some of the strategies that you use? So that was our opening. Those were some of the things we talked about at first. I did a read aloud, and I have to make an adjustment here. It wasn't from All Kinds of Minds. It actually was from Dr. Levine's Keeping Ahead in School. In that book, each chapter is devoted to a different learning pathway, and I chose the attention chapter to start with. And in the beginning of each chapter, there was a narrative that was maybe 4 pages about a student who struggled with that particular learning pathway. So Stan was the student here, and he struggled with attention. So we did a read aloud, and in a minute I'll show you what we did during the read aloud. I have a work sample to show you. We moved on from Stan, but we spent a long time talking and analyzing Stan and really connecting ourselves to Stan. We did short reading assignments that I gave them, also from Keeping Ahead in School, that were, maybe a page or two each on specific learning components within attention. Okay, so the kids were really learning at a pretty good level about the intricacies of attention, and they were riveted by it. They were so interested in how complex their attention was, and they really started to understand that it wasn't as if you're really good at paying attention or you're not good at paying attention, that we all have parts of our attention that are good and some that are not working so well. They really did a great analysis of that, but they became experts in a particular component. And they shared those with each other. And then they decided for a culminating project that they wanted to make the fourth grade hallway Attention Road, and that was totally their idea. So they made signs, street signs, Attention Road, and they put their information and strategy posters for their different components. It really became a mini research project for them. For example, if they were talking about impulsivity, they would give information about it, and they would put strategies. Some came from the book, and some were just their own strategies that they developed for, you know, that particular component. Okay, so that's the big picture. And again, this is a longer term endeavor. This is not something you have to do, but if you're so inclined, this is, you know, something that you could try. Let me just give you a sense of what some of their work looked like. I picked a couple that were interesting on the next slide. This we did, again, I needed to get my skills in here, and one of the things I needed to do was take a nonfiction piece and organize the information. So we compared ourselves, now this was a student named Annie, with Stan. So you can see she did a really nice job, as did lots of the children, comparing herself. So I daydream once in a while, Stan daydreams a lot. But in the middle, we both have a good sense of humor, we both have a good imagination, etc. Okay? Sometimes I get bored, right? Stan gets bored in school really easily. Interesting also, look at what came out here. Stan worries about himself. I get worried with myself if I get a bad grade, right? Lots of really interesting, very metacognitive, interesting thoughts came out. The kids were really thinking about themselves throughout this experience. And then the last slide here is, as part of this, I don't exactly remember when we did this T-chart within the sequence that I showed you, but a simple T-chart. These are things that might make paying attention difficult, and these are some strategies to help a person with their attention. Now, one of the reasons I chose Raymond was because he was a great kid, and he was a very successful student. He got very good grades. He was in a gifted and talented program in New Jersey when I worked with him. He was not, by any means, a struggling student, but he did struggle with his attention sometimes. And that was really interesting for the kids to learn as well through this kind of mini unit, was that even the kids who did really well, it really had nothing to do about grades. All kids struggle sometimes. And it was really interesting for him to notice that about himself and for the other kids to know, gosh, if Raymond struggles with his attention, it's okay, right? It's okay that I'm struggling with mine a bit too. I love that he thinks that it's hard to pay attention when the teacher's talking too much. I just thought that was very funny, being that I was the teacher. Made me think a little bit. And I also love the two that I pointed out here, strategies. He shook his legs all the time, and I thought that was so interesting that he knew that that was an attention strategy for him. And also, if the teacher could talk less, that would help him. He was somebody who wanted little talk, and he just wanted to jump right into the work. That was part of his style. So I thought that was a great reflection on his part. Okay, the kids really love to talk about themselves. The more you can get them talking about their learning, the richer your discussions about learning will be with them. Okay, I know I'm at 10 after 9. If you could just give me, this is your ticket to leave, our last slide. I know I talked a lot. I so wanted you to get lots of ideas. So I wish, in retrospect, I could have gotten more and more of yours, but I know you were listening and thinking and probably hopefully jotting ideas down as I was talking a lot. Does anybody have an idea about how you might begin this work? Were any ideas sparked for you that you might try? Let's shoot for two ideas. The Venn diagram. Okay, try it with a sixth grader. And again, Dr. Levine's books are wonderful for starting these conversations. I would really recommend them. They're written to work with students. Enlist colleagues to brainstorm together. What a great idea. What a great idea, particularly if other people are listening to this webinar and part of this webinar. And even if they're not, right, start these conversations. What can we do? How can we start? Any other ideas? Okay, well, I want to thank all of you for a wonderful hour, as usual. I always learn a lot from you, and I hope you felt the webinar was helpful to you as well. And I would encourage you, little steps. I ended with, a big mini unit. I really want you to think about little steps. How can you maybe work in a discussion over the next couple of days? Not even a discussion, just a question here or there, helping kids to reflect on their learning process, what worked for them, what didn't, what they would change next time. If you can start to work those questions into your teaching, you would have done a very valuable service. And if you can do more, wonderful. But little steps, right? Little steps go a long way. So thank you so much for a wonderful, wonderful discussion, and I wish you all the best. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Kelly, for such an informative and at the same time really encouraging session. It was you brought so many amazing ideas to the table. Thank you.